I think we'll begin. Good to see you. And it is a particular pleasure for me to welcome Professor Ibrahim Abu-Rabi here this evening. Some of you heard him a year or so ago, I believe, when he spoke here at the university. Professor Abu-Rabi has taken up the Edmonton Muslim Community's chair in Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. He comes to us from our southern neighbor. One of the, I suppose, benefits of some of the struggles around politics and around Islam has probably made it a little easier for him to make his home among us. Some people's tragedy is the blessing of Canada. It is an old, old story. Ibrahim has been co-director of the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Christian-Muslim Relations at Hartford Seminary for a number of years, and has been engaged in a wide interfaith conversation with Jews and Christians. I know that even if I had wanted to resist his interesting way of going about the world, it would have been impossible for me when I found out that he was born in Nazareth. And I, of course, grew up with another person who was born in Nazareth. Ibrahim grew up speaking Hebrew and Arabic, and he is really one of the world's leading scholars on contemporary Islamic thought. He's edited the very large Blackwell's volume on contemporary Muslim thought. Is very wide-reaching in his work, both intellectually as well as his relationship to Muslim thinkers in Malaysia, Indonesia, Turkey, all the way up to Algeria. So I'm particularly pleased that you're with us tonight. I'd also like to mention that the two of us are going to be leading a study tour to Syria and Turkey from April 25th to May 10th. And if any of you are interested in exploring that or know people who are, we'd be happy to talk with you about it. It'll be a somewhat unusual study tour in that there'll be an opportunity to engage in conversation across the or with both Christians and Muslim thinkers in those countries, as well as people who are involved in the politics of those countries. So this evening, Professor Abu-Rabi is going to speak with us on trends in contemporary Muslim world, nationalism and religion in Turkey and Indonesia. And there will be a chance for us to talk with him a little bit following his formal remarks. I'm delighted you're here.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you, David, so much for this introduction. Before I begin my talk, I'd like to say more about the study tour that David and I are going to co-lead beginning April 25th. It will take us to Turkey for a week and then to Syria for another week. And I've heard from a number of people that they are scared of the idea of going to Syria. Although Syria, I believe, is much more stable than Manhattan or Brooklyn, New York, in terms of safety and security. But what's amazing about Syria is that Syria has a large community of Christians, a very ancient Christian community, that 10% of the Syrian population is Christian. And the Christian community is quite diverse. You know, I remember when I was reading about the early Islamic expansion in Syria in the 7th century, the Syrian Christians accepted Islam on the premise that Islam was another Christian heresy that was coming from Arabia. So it was normal to accept that heresy in Syria, so to speak. But I would encourage you, if you have the time and the money, to apply for the study tour, and I'm sure that you would enjoy it. Today I'm going to speak briefly about not only about Turkey and Indonesia, but about Indonesia, Turkey, and Pakistan. And it's going to be brief. I'm going to raise a number of issues, and I'm sure that we'll have ample time to talk about these issues in a systematic and deep way. As you remember, perhaps what's important for us in the modern Muslim world nowadays is to look at the relationship between what we call theology and politics in classical Islam as well as in modern Islam. And I think that the classical relationship between theology, between religion and the state, has a major bearing on the contemporary relationship between religion and state in a number of Muslim countries today. And when I speak about the Muslim world, as you well know, I do not speak only about the Middle East. The Middle East is just a small chunk of the Muslim world, although it has attracted so much mass media. But the Muslim world is much larger than the Arab world and the Middle East. I think that most of the action of contemporary Islam is to be seen beyond the so-called Middle East, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Indonesia, and Malaysia, and so on and so forth. But the classical relationship between theology and politics is very significant, because that's when we begin to witness, in the first century of Islam, the first major civil war within Islam, and the subsequent division between what we call Shi'ism and Sunnism nowadays. And of course, we in the field of Islamic studies usually receive so many questions about the differences between Shiites and Sunnites. Those differences that we have begun to hear about, especially since the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003. But if we look at the classical relationship between Shi'ism and Sunnism, what we discover is that from the very beginning, Sunnism, that's to say the Sunni clergy, the Sunni clerical class, has never been in power in any Muslim country. On the contrary, if we look at the classical Islamic era and the different political and military elites within Islam, those who had been in power within Islam, all of these elites, of course, most of them had been Sunnites by tradition, by school. But they did not come, they did not hail from a clerical class that we call Sunnism. That's to say, in other words, that the political and military elites in early Islam, in classical Islam, as well as in contemporary Islam, to my mind, have exploited Sunnism and religion in order to justify, preserve, and expand their own status quo. And whereas if you look at Shi'ism, and the Shi'ites have been a minority in Islam from the beginning, that the Shi'ites in the long Islamic centuries have been able to establish some powerful Islamic states in the name of the Shi'ite clerisy. And one major example in history had been the Fatimid Ismaili state, set up in, first of all, in present-day Tunisia. It was called Ifriqiya at the time, Africa, by the Arab historians, in 909. And in 1966, the center of the Ismaili Fatimid state moves from Tunisia to Cairo. And as a matter of fact, Cairo was established by the Ismaili Fatimids in 1970 or so. And the famous Azhar University, which is very similar to the Vatican in the Catholic world, was established in 970, in the 10th century, by the Fatimid Ismailis as a center for the spread of Fatimid Ismaili philosophy, mysticism, knowledge, etc., etc. So that's one major historical example where the Shi'ite clerisy was in power. And the second major example is that of Iran nowadays. That the Islamic revolution of Iran of 78-79 was launched in the name of Islam and not in the name of secularism or Iranian nationalism, although there had been strong Iranian nationalist elements in the Islamic revolution of Iran, but in the name also, above all, in the name of the Shiite clerisy. And the symbol of that clerisy had been Ayatollah Khomeini. The symbol of the clerisy in the Fatimid Ismaili state had been the imams who had been in power. And I was reading the other day on a classic study on the Ismaili Fatimids in Egypt. The imam who was the ruler or the caliph, he was called in Arabic Al-Quran al-Natiq. That's to say, the talking Quran. Whereas the text, the Quran, is the silent Quran. That's to say that in Shia Ismailism, there is no need for exegesis, what we call tafsir, the exegesis of the Quranic text, because the imam has the privilege, the only privilege, to explain and interpret the text to his audiences. So these are some major examples where Shiites who have been a minority in Islam, perhaps less than 5%, who have established states in the classical era as well as in the modern era in the name of their own clerisy. But no such state has been established in the name of the Sunnite clerisy. And that's why when we say that, you know, there is a famous Islamic motto that state and religion are one, this is only in theory. That's to say that most Sunnite theoreticians and ideologues have stood on the sides of the state. They have been either exploited by the state or they have opposed the state. And that's what we see nowadays in the Sunnite Muslim world. That on the one hand, Sunnism as a doctrine is very much exploited by a large number of political elites in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Syria, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Indonesia, whatever. Or if they are not exploited, if they refuse to be exploited, they stand on the side, they are either quietist or they oppose the status quo. Now, what does that mean in terms of the three countries that I'd like to talk about briefly, Indonesia, Pakistan, as well as Turkey? Now, in those three countries, I believe we are talking about three substantially different models of the relationship between theology or religion and state in those countries. In the Indonesian state, in the Indonesian case, we have, when Indonesia was founded in 1945, and when the constitution was written down, the constitution of Indonesia states explicitly that Indonesia is not a state to be based on Islamic Sharia. This is very clear in the Indonesian state. That's to say that Sharia, although most of the people of Indonesia are Muslim, but Islamic Sharia, Islamic law, cannot run the affairs of that Muslim society. But Indonesia does not consider itself to be a secular nation or a secular state, but a theistic state. A state that is based on the concept of a plurality of religions, of five religions. That's to say that the Indonesian constitution is based on theism, not on Islamic Sharia, and every religion has the right. Every people have the right to practice their own religion in their own way without any Islamic hegemony, although Muslims are the majority number-wise in Indonesia. And this is extremely interesting as a model. This is the only model that I know of. For example, in the neighboring country of Malaysia, as you well know, the Melayu people of Malaysia are almost 40% of the population. But the Chinese of Malaysia are 40% as well. And we have 20% who are mixed Hindus and Muslims from India or Sikhs from India. But the Chinese and the Malayu constitute the majority in the state of Malaysia. But Malaysia has never declared itself to be an Islamic state from the very beginning, but a nation state, a secular nation state. But in society itself, there is a major dichotomy and polarization between the Chinese, most of whom are Buddhist, and between the Malayu, most of whom are Muslim. As a matter of fact, all of whom are Muslim, and all of whom are Sunnite Muslims. So the Malayu people feel that Malaysia is their own state, and this state has to conform to the model of Sunni Islam, and that the clerisy has to be in power. But this has not been the case since the independence of Malaysia in 1965-66. Now, if you look at the example of Pakistan, Pakistan is a very strange case. And in certain ways, Pakistan reminds us of the case of Israel. Because Pakistan was invented as a state for the Muslims of India. In the same vein, Israel had been invented as a state for the Jews of the world. But most of the Muslims of India refused to migrate to Pakistan. In the same way, most of the Jews of the world have refused to migrate to Israel. Although, if you are Jewish, living in Siberia or Ethiopia or Edmonton, you have more rights than the natives of Palestine. And you would be given a passport if you migrate or do Aliyah in Hebrew and this and that. But the majority of the Jews of the world so far have not migrated to the state of Israel. And in India, we have more Muslims than the Muslims of Pakistan. There are roughly around 160 million Muslims in India. And that's a large number of people in a country that is not Islamic. That's to say that the number of Muslims in India is much larger than the number of Muslims in the Gulf states combined. And as you well know, the mass media talks so much about Islam in the Gulf, but so little about Islam and Muslim culture and Muslim history and civilization in India or South Asia. Now, in the Turkish case, we have an entirely different case of the relationship between religion and state. And this is mainly, it's a case where religion has been, where the Kemalist secularists in Turkey, who came to power in the 1920s, had been trying to remove religion from the public sphere. But I believe that they have failed in a major way for a number of reasons that I'll talk about later on. But when Kemalism came, when Kemal Atatürk came to Turkey in the 1920s, and when he set up his own Turkish state, his idea that this state is for only the Turks. It is a nation state, and this nation state must be westernized. That's to say that he tried to cut off any relationship between Turkey and its own Ottoman past, or Islamic past, or even pre-Islamic past. That this is a newly invented state that we call Turkey. It is for its own citizens, and all of the citizens must be Turkish. Even the Kurds cannot say that we are Kurds, and that's why the Kurds until now are not allowed to use Kurdish mass media or Kurdish newspapers. That's still illegal in Turkey, to publish newspapers in Kurdish or to have TV or radio stations in the Kurdish language, because every citizen of Turkey must be a Turk and not a Kurd or Armenian or Greek or Arab or Laz or Zaza or whatever. Now, this extreme model of secular westernized Turkey since the 1920s has been trying to, first of all, reduce the position of religion within the state and within society. And it has been able to somewhat to control religious institutions and religious ideas in Turkish society to an extent that in Turkey since 1922, no one can teach Islam outside of the purview of the state. That's to say, you as an independent citizen of the Turkish state cannot open up, let's say, a madrasa or a seminary to teach Islam on your own. Islam has to be taught by the state. That's to say, Islam has to be controlled by the state. And you cannot even teach Islam in a mosque on your own. Of course, you can do that at your own, in your own house, in your own home, but not in a mosque. That's to say, all mosques and Islamic centers are being controlled by the state, and the clergy are paid for by the state, and that what that means in a sense that clergy cannot rebel against the state and cannot establish a state of their own in a country that we call Turkey. But in the past 20 years or so, there have been many signs for the failure of this model of radical, secular, westernized Turkey. And one major sign had been the corruption of the Kemalist secular intelligentsia. That was one major sign. And the second major sign was the fact that this intelligentsia had been trying to deny and negate its own historical roots, at least Ottoman roots, by saying we are not Ottomans, we are a new people, we are Kemalist, our father is Kemal Ataturk, and this and that. But this model has failed in a major way. And that's why what we see today is a moderate Islamist movement in power, in government, in Turkey. It's a movement that came from the womb and the territory of Islamism, activist Islamism. And it came from within what we call the Refah Party. The Refah Party is in Turkey that was set up basically in the 1960s. It's a movement that, in a sense, had been and still is anti-Kemalist and anti-secular in nature, although it has been saying that we want to work within the preview of Kemalism and secularism, but it is anti-secularism and anti-Kemalism. But of course, as a movement, although it is in power, although it holds the reins of the government, that movement is not as powerful as the army, because Kemalism is still centered within the army. And the army has the major say in Turkish life and Turkish politics, and that's why we see a major dichotomy nowadays in this model of the relationship between religion and state, between the army that is Kemalist to the core and between the government that has been controlled by Islamists in the past 5 or 6 years, a government that has, in a sense, reduced inflation, controlled the level of corruption in society, had been a dynamo behind the economy and education, and this and that, and a government that has been much more open to the Arab and the Islamic milieu than any Kemalist government in the past. And in a sense, this government is sophisticated enough to try to strike a balance between its own ideals and the reality of the Turkish state where the army is still in power. Now, if we go to Pakistan, and the Pakistan case, I think, has been a terrible mess since the foundation of Pakistan in November of 1947. The Pakistan case has been a terrible mess because from the very beginning, Pakistan had not been certain about its own identity. Is Pakistan a state for the Muslims of South Asia, or is it an Islamic state? And there's a difference between these two different terms or terminologies. If it is an Islamic state, that means that Pakistan has to be run by the Islamic Sharia, by Islamic constitution. But if it is a state for the Muslims of South Asia, it means that it can become any type of state, a secular state or military state or this and that. And it is not very clear from Pakistani philosophy, that's to say from the philosophy of the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who passed away 13 months after the foundation of Pakistan, who had been a successful lawyer in Bombay, India, and who had gone to Cambridge and Oxford in England to study. A man who spoke only English, although he knew Urdu, but he would address his own people in English. That man, it is not very clear from his own statements whether he wanted to establish an Islamic state or a state for the Muslims of South Asia. But there is no doubt that since 1947, Pakistan has been created as a state perhaps for the Muslims of South Asia, but essentially it has been a military state. There have been lots of coup d'etats from the army, from the military elite. Nowadays, the new elite is not military in nature, but until a few months ago, the elite was military under Musharraf, and before Musharraf, of course, was Zia-ul-Haq, who fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan through sending lots of mujahideen and accepting American financial aid and American arms to fight against the infidels in Afghanistan and that part of the world. But there's no doubt that in terms of that relationship between politics and religion in Pakistan, that although the majority of the people of Pakistan are Muslim, and although the majority are Sunni Muslim, of course there is a substantial number of Muslims who are Shiites, and some Ismaili communities in different parts of Pakistan. But although the majority are Sunni Muslims, the Pakistanis have not been able to establish a Sunni Islamic state to be based on Islamic constitution. And this is mainly because of the confusion that I referred to of the essential Pakistani identity, whether it is an Islamic state or a state for the Muslims of India. But also it is related to classical Islam and the fact that no Sunni state had ever been established throughout Islamic history. If the Shiites were the majority in Pakistan, most probably we would have a Shiite state run by Shiite clerisy or Shiite clergy within Pakistan. But that's not the case. The Shiites are not the majority. One of the major weaknesses of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan before 9/11, before the tragic attacks in the USA, had been that the Taliban had attacked with vengeance the Shiite community in the western part of Afghanistan. And they are called the Hazara Shiites, who speak Dari. Dari is a dialect of Persian. But they are Shiites. And they, in a sense, their own world is very much tied up to the world of Persian as a language, Persian culture, and above all, Shiism. And these people had the power, with the help of Iran, perhaps to establish a Shiite state in Afghanistan. You know, we can understand why the Taliban and the Iranians were at odds with each other, mainly because the Taliban represented that austere, fundamentalist, Sunnite Islam, whereas the Iranians represented their own version of Shiite Islam. And Iran is a much bigger and more sophisticated country than Afghanistan. But in a sense, there was a major struggle between Iran and Pakistan over Afghanistan. And in that sense, Iran had lent a helping hand to both India and later on the USA and NATO in conquering or invading Afghanistan. From that angle, Iran is playing a significant role in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq because of Shiism, because of that notion of Shiism. Now, let me just state briefly the current situation in Iraq, because that's also significant for us. In Iraq also, we find this model nowadays of the Shiite clerisy being in power. You know, of course, the Iraqi parliament, one might say, it has come through democratic elections. You find the Kurds represented, some Sunnites, not the majority, but some, a few. There will be elections coming up, I believe, in January of next year. But the majority of the people in power in Iraq nowadays are Shiites. And they are not just Shiites, but they come from the clerical class of Shiism, a class that is very ancient within Iraq, a class that was supported for many years during the Iraq-Iran conflict between Saddam Hussein and Iran, for many years by the Iranians, a class of people who became exiles in Iran and who returned after the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And they are now in power. And this is one of the major contradictions of the American foreign policy, that the Americans perhaps did not think far enough about the consequences of their own occupation of Iraq, that the American occupation of Iraq would, in a sense, land Iraq into the lap of Shiite clerisy. And that's what has happened, that the Shiites are in power not only in Iran, but in Iraq as well. And this has created so much nervousness amongst the Arabs in the Gulf, in Egypt, in Jordan. Why? Because now the Arabs are saying if Iraq and Iran were to be reunited, and Iran is our own traditional historical enemy, then Iran would have major incursions, not only in the Gulf states, but in North Africa and so on and so forth. And therefore, what we see in the past year or so, a major Sunni reaction to Shiism in the name of the symbols of Sunnism in the Arab and Muslim world, attacking Shiism and saying that the Shiites are not authentic Muslims. You know, it's like you've never heard of that 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Maybe you heard of that in the 19th century when the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia occupied Iraq and all of that. But I never heard of that growing up in the Middle East. But now, you know, especially if you know Arabic and you read the Arabic press, there has been a systematic and severe Sunni attack on Shiism and the Shiites. And I know that from my Syrian friends. As you well know, Syria is primarily a Sunni country. But since 1970, it has been ruled by a small Alawite community. And the Alawites are extreme Shiites. And some of the Alawites think that Ali, the cousin of the Prophet, the founder of Shiism, was divine. In a sense, they, you know, they ascribe divinity notions or characteristics to the personality of Ali. And in Islam, this is blasphemy, because Ali was just a human being. But to the Alawites, Ali was a god or semi-god or so on and so forth. And they have been in power in Syria since 1970, at the time Hafez Assad came to power, and now his son Assad, who comes from the same family, Bashar al-Assad, represents that trend of thought. But if you look at the, if you talk with the Sunni clergy in Syria, and there is a large and well-established clerical class, Sunni clerical class in Syria and Damascus and Aleppo and other cities, is that they are extremely nervous about the spread and dissemination of Shiism in Syria. And this time, not Alawite Shiism, but Iranian-style Shiism, that the Iranians are investing so much money, not only with Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also in Shiite religious institutions in Syria. And some people are afraid that the higher echelons of the Ba'athist party in Syria, the higher people are converting to Iranian-style Shiism, which means that the Shiites are trying, according to this perspective, are trying to infiltrate into the Ba'ath party and control the state in the name of Ba'athist Shiism, Iranian Shiism. And this is such a scary thought to many Sunnites, and primarily because the Sunnites have never had a chance in their history to control the state. But now we have an example of the Shiites controlling the state in Iran, the Shiites controlling the state in Iraq, the Shiites controlling the state even in Lebanon through Hezbollah. And the Shiites of Lebanon are just a minority, whereas the Sunnites, who are the majority in Lebanon or Syria or Egypt or whatever, in any other Muslim country except Iran and Iraq, have had no chance whatsoever to control the state, the reins of power. And so that, therefore, that tells you about what's going on in the Muslim world nowadays. And I think that, to my mind, the most stable model that perhaps will succeed will be the Indonesian model. Of course, there are other factors that will determine the success and failure of any model, one of which is the economic factor. There's no doubt about it. And social justice in society. Social justice is lacking in a country like Indonesia. Indonesia has a very, very complicated stratification of society. Most of the people are poor and this and that. But their own model of the relationship between state and religion, to my mind, is a sane and sound model. Whereas the model that we have in Pakistan has been conflicting from the very beginning. It has been ambivalent about its own self from the very beginning. The model that we have in Iran is stable because of the power of the Shia clergy and because of the alliance between the clergy, what we call the bazaar, the clergy and the bazaar, that's to say the merchants in Iran, and above all the clergy, the bazaar, and the army in Iran. Of course, you know, these are not the same thing, because the army is a very sophisticated army in Iran. The army has had secret dealings with the state of Israel, even under Khomeini, but there's no doubt that the upper echelon of the army is controlled by the Shia clergy, and there's that type of strong alliance. We don't see a dichotomy within Iran like the one that we see in Turkey, between the army and the Islamist government of Turkey. But I think that this model is stable as long as the Shiite clergy has the power to maintain that stability. And it seems that so far it has succeeded in maintaining that stability. And I think that the U.S. occupation of Iraq, as well as the U.S. NATO occupation of Afghanistan, has given that clergy another lease on life. It has expanded the power of clergy beyond its own borders. That's what the clergy wanted after 1979. Remember that when Khomeini came to power, his major motto had been to popularize and export the tenets of the Islamic revolution, especially to Iraq and the Arab world. And he failed. That's why Saddam Hussein entered in an 8-year war against him, and Khomeini failed in exporting the Islamic revolution of Iran. But the NATO and the American occupation of both Afghanistan and Iraq has enabled the Khomeini revolution, after his own death, to export its own ideology to both of these countries. So Iran is much more powerful today than it was 5 years ago, thanks to the Americans and thanks to the NATO. So I'm going to stop here, and I'm sure that you have many questions to raise.
Is there within the various militant movements in Islam, is there any notion on the Sunni side?
Yes.
I mean, we think of that a lot. Is there any notion or aspiration to build a state model, given the way you have mapped the fact that that hasn't occurred in the past? Is part of the movement that we see some kind of expression of aspiration towards that? And then secondly, or maybe related to this, can you say a little bit about the relationship within these stronger religious movements? Is there anyone who's trying to bridge that Sunni-Shia
divide? Yeah. In terms of the latter question, there has been an attempt since 1958 between Sunni and Shia clergy that is called, they have met under the umbrella of what we call in Arabic Majma' al-Taqrib bayn al-Madhahib al-Islamiyya, the Committee of Reconciliation amongst the Islamic Mazhabs or Schools of Law. And this committee convenes an annual meeting in Tehran. And I was invited once. I wasn't able to go. But it's a famous committee established between the Azhar in Cairo and Qom in Iran under the Shah at the time and under Nasser in Egypt. So there has been that attempt. But nowadays, there is a major split between Shiism and Sunnism for the reasons that I have mentioned, especially because of the Iranian expansion. And the Iranian expansion is not just material or physical or financial. It is religious too. The expansion of Shiism, especially in the Sunni world, that the Iranians are willing to finance that expansion and to stand behind it, not just behind, let's say, Hezbollah in Lebanon, but they are willing to finance the Shiites in Syria, the Shiites in Saudi Arabia, the Shiites in Iraq, the Shiites in Yemen, and some Shiites in Egypt and North Africa. In terms of the first question, there's no doubt that Sunni Islamism, not just Bin Laden is a new phenomenon, the Qaeda is a new phenomenon, it's only 10, 12 years old. Sunni fundamentalism from the very beginning, from the 1920s on, has had that model of capturing the state, that it has, in a sense, reflected or in a sense said that we cannot establish authentic Islam in the 20th century unless we are able to control the state. That's to say, Islam, authentic Islam, can be practiced only within the context and parameters of an Islamic state. But so they have that in terms of their ideological program. But that's not the question. The question is that, as a matter of political fact, they have not been able to establish a Sunni Islamic state, whereas the Shiites have been able to establish that, at least in two cases. In the case of Iran in 79, in the case of Iraq nowadays. Iraq for different reasons and under different circumstances, but I think that the result has been the same. Yes.
Can I just follow that up with, when I saw and watched the blowing up of major Shia sites
in Iraq.
In Iraq. I mean, I just simply couldn't believe this. And my thought was, how can any self-respecting Muslim do this?
Yeah.
I mean, I know enough about the history of Christianity to know that this is not unusual. But it's horrific to see.
Yes, yes.
So you have helped clarify that a little bit. Is it in your view also, is there, obviously this is a geopolitical issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Americans and those in NATO and what have you, by now, are at least knowledgeable enough about it, maybe they were from the get-go, to make use of this.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I mean, I don't want to lead us into the swamp necessarily, but do you see that some of that awful struggle between those two parties is also being manipulated, being used?
Yes.
Or is it?
I think that it has been used. It had been used in the past, let's say by the British in Iran and South Asia. But this is only, I believe, a consequence of a major transformative act done by the USA after the US invasion of Iraq. Because I think that what the US did was really to give Iraq to Iran without Iran firing even one shot.
Initially.
Now, of course, they are regretting that they have done that. But doing that, to me, is the most substantial act in the contemporary history of Iraq. That in a sense that the Americans have joined Iraq with Iran, perhaps against its own will. But this has been the major consequence. Of course, in terms of destroying holy places and all of that, many, many Iraqis blame the Americans doing that. I don't know the truth of the matter, but what I know is that, as you do, is that Shiism from the very beginning has been a tiny secretive movement within Islam, from the very beginning. And from the very beginning it had gone underground in the first Islamic centuries. And it began to appear or reappear only in the 19th century. Under the Qajar dynasty in Iran. I'm sure that many of you are aware of the Baha'i faith. And the Baha'i faith emerged in Iran in the 19th century. And basically, Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, was a Shi'ite cleric. And he wanted a certain form of renaissance for Shi'ism. But his own understanding of renaissance or revival was not accepted by the larger Shiite clerisy in Iran. Because Baha'u'llah went for a pacifist understanding of Islam. But they wanted an activist understanding of Islam. That is, they wanted to control the state, even in the 19th century. And that was not the understanding of Baha'u'llah in terms of the revival of Shi'ism. And that's why later on the Baha'i founders were forced to say that we are founding a new religion or religious phenomenon that we call the Baha'i faith, which is substantially different from Shi'ism. But it's not. It's the approach is different. Is that the Baha'is wanted to be more on the quietist, pacifist side. They did not have the power and the labor, so to speak, to establish their own Baha'i state or Shi'ite state within Iran. And that's why they were exiled to Ottoman Palestine in the 19th century. But because of the secretive nature of Shi'ism, now with the Shi'ites having a state in Iran, that's a big thing in the 20th century. It's a major thing. And now having a second state in Iraq, that's also another major achievement of Shi'ism. Although they are a minority, but that's a huge achievement. And my point is that the Sunnites have not been able to achieve 10% of what the Shi'ites have achieved in the modern era. Yes?
The lack of a Sunni religious state in the Sana al-Shi'i, is that because of the differing Sunni traditions of law?
I think that the major reason is that Sunnism as a methodology and legal school took at least 250 years to 300 years to mature in early Islam. So it did not have the time to establish its own state, because the state had already been captured by secular political elites that we are called the Umayyads. I don't know how much you know about early Islamic history. And by another political elite that was called the Abbaside, that used Sunnism, and later on they used Greek philosophy, rationalism. They had fallen under the influence of Hellenism, Hellenistic philosophy, and later on they went into a series of decline, and that decline was taken advantage of by military elites, by new military elites who came to the Abbasid Empire in the 9th and the 10th centuries. And those elites were called the Mamluks or the Turks. The Turks had begun to migrate from Central Asia to the Arab world at the time, to the Middle East at the time. You know, I don't know how much you know about the differences between, in Islamic sources, between the Quran as a divine source and between the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet of Islam. In Islam, we make that distinction. In Islamic studies, a distinction is made between the Quran as the primary source of Islam, the Quran is divinely inspired, and between the Hadith, the collection of sayings of the Prophet of Islam. But early Muslims, when the Prophet was still alive, refused to collect the sayings of the Prophet for fear that Muslims would confuse between the sayings of Muhammad, who was a fallible human being, and the sayings of God, who is not fallible. But Muslims began to collect the sayings of the Prophet perhaps 100 years or so after his own death. And that's why in the Hadith literature we make a distinction between a fake Hadith, fake saying of the Prophet, authentic Hadith, or a Hadith that is bayna bayn, in between. You know, all of us are in between. And there is a famous Hadith that was invented, that is fake, 100% fake, that was invented in the 10th century in the Abbasid state about the Turks. That goes as follows: Utrukul atraka matarakukum. Leave the Turks as long as they leave you alone. If they love you, they steal from you, and if they hate you, they kill you. Now, that Hadith could not have been said by the Prophet of Islam, because there was no Turk to be found in Mecca and Medina at the time. The Turkish element was somewhat new. It came like 200 years or so after the death of the Prophet, in the final stage of the Abbasid state, when the state began to be weak. So that those were military elites. And you know, it's like if you look at the long history of Egypt after the Fatimid Empire collapse, we have what we call the Mamluks. In Arabic, the Mamluks, they were slaves brought from Circassia and Georgia. They were Circassian and Christian slaves who were converted to Islam and given Islamic training, but they were military men and who ruled not only Egypt but the Near East for almost 600 years. And the same happened in India, in Islamic India. Before the Mughal Empire was established in the 16th century, it was the Mamluks from the 13th century all the way to the 16th in power in Delhi and other cities in India. So from that angle, the Sunnite clerisy had never been given the chance to establish a Sunnite state. Whereas because of the secretive nature of Shia propaganda and the Shia movement and the Shia mission, and the fact that the Shiites have been a minority, and the fact that their leaders have been in hiding, that the Shiites have had a better sense of theological integrity than the Sunnites. That's to say, they have always known what they wanted. They wanted to control the state through an imam, and the imam would be the religious leader as well as political leader, and the imam would be in a sense the shade of God on earth. He was the divine representative on earth. Now this type of theory is not very clear in Sunnism. On the contrary, we have other political manifestations of Sunni Islam, one of which is an unjust ruler is better to Muslims than a just ruler who cannot control his own dominion. That's to say that Sunni political theory prefers injustice, political injustice, as long as that injustice controls the state and preserves stability, political and social stability in the state. Yeah. So there are significant differences, you know. I mean, you hear that from many Muslims, Islam is one. That is true. But in terms of the expressions of Islamic cultures and the different Islamic ideologies, we cannot really say that there has been only one monolithic Islamic ideology from the beginning of Islam until now. There have been different Islamic ideologies vying for power or source of power, authority, either religious authority or political authority. And you can argue that in the text of Islam, in the Quran, that political authority and theocratic authority are not to be separated. You can do that argument. You can argue in such a way. But in practice, in history, political authority has had the upper hand over theological authority. And I believe that most of the Sunni clergy have been exploited by the political elites within Muslim states and societies until now. Whereas the Shias, because of their own secretive nature and secretive history and the fact that they are a minority and the fact that their own theology has been interpreted by the Imam, by one person, that they have been able to capture the state because of that sense of integrity that they have.
Can I ask you to think a little bit more about Turkey with us? I was in Turkey in 99. I think it was an anniversary for Ataturk.
Yeah.
And it was like pictures that I'd seen from the Soviet Union. The visage of Ataturk.
That's right.
Looking at you no matter where you were.
Yeah, yeah.
They also passed, if I recall correctly, they passed a new law or policy indicating that no woman who had her head covered could work in the civil service or in any government office or go to any university. It was part of this virulent secularism that you spoke about for us. I also recall that under Ataturk, the remnant Greek Orthodox community, in Turkey, there's been this big exchange of populations, of course. Mm-hmm. But the remnant community was not allowed to have any kind of religious school.
That's right.
And I even went to the island, I mentioned this to you, where that one of the big Greek seminaries had been, and there was caretakers there.
Mm-hmm.
But this huge institution was absolutely empty. Now, it's my understanding that with the new government, it's kind of interesting when you think about this. When you have this virulent secularism, how they deal with religion is through state control of it and the banishment of it. I mean, both those things work depending on the circumstances. But with the new government, which is much more interested in religion, there was some discussion, I don't know what the state of it is, that government was also willing to talk to the Ecumenical Patriarch.
Yes.
And to open up the possibility of Greek Orthodox education in the country. Can you just speak about that?
Yes. Thank you. You know, there are lots of books that talk about that, and one of them is written by a friend of mine who's a Canadian journalist based in the East, Fred Reed, R-E-E-D. The title of the book is Anatolia Injunction, or is that the title? Yes. And he talks about the Greek Orthodox seminars and all of that. As you know, as I said, in the modern Kemalist state, all religious institutions are controlled by the state. So in terms of teaching Islam, it is primarily done by the state. And let me just elaborate on this and then come to the Greek Orthodox side. I lived in Turkey for almost a year and a half. And a few years back, I decided to go to the East for a few weeks and visit Islamic centers and Muslim institutions and universities and all of that. So I went to the city of Van, which is only 1 hour away from the Iranian border. And Van is primarily a Kurdish city. And they have a university in Van that is called Kemal Ataturk University. It's a state university. All universities, well, not all, most of the universities are state universities. And that university has a department of Islamic studies. And in that department, they have, at the time, they had like 70 professors. In Turkish, it's called Ilahiyat faculty. Ilahiyat, like divinity schools, such as like in Harvard, similar to the one. Because they wanted to westernize their own teaching of Islam. So they are called divinity schools, not Islamic studies programs or Sharia programs. So they had 70 professors in that divinity school, but no students. Why? Because the government did not want the Kurdish students to study Islam, even Turkish Islam, even passive Islam. They barred the students from studying in that divinity school, and the professors who were government employees had nothing to do. They were just sitting, receiving a salary, and nothing to do. You know, we would have loved that here in Edmonton, yeah. But now the... Yeah, but now we don't have any more oil money. The oil market has collapsed, so we don't have any extra money. So so that tells you a lot about, you know, that crazy way of controlling religious institutions in present-day Turkey. Now, in terms of the Christian side, under Kemalism, it was even much worse for a number of reasons, but for one significant reason, that there is no doubt that the history of the Ottoman Empire and the history of modern Turkey had been built on the negation of the history of other peoples, religions, and communities. It had been built on the negation of Armenian history, of Byzantine history, and Greek history. There's no doubt about it, you know, from a historical way. And this is still very strong in the historical identity of the modern Turks. And that's why modern Turkey, present-day Turkey, still cannot admit that the Turkish state under the Young Turks between 1914 and 1918 committed large massacres against the Armenian population of Turkey. It cannot admit to that fact. Although it is a historical fact and there are lots of documents to prove that, this and that, but present-day Turkey cannot bring itself to acknowledge those tragic events in the history of its own Armenian citizens. Therefore, in terms of closing down seminaries and not allowing seminaries to practice or to open up, this is, I believe, it is in sync with that type of policy. It is to deny the indigenous Christians their own right to education, their own type of education. But I think with the current government, it just allowed those seminaries to open to reopen a few months ago. And also the current government has banned, the Kemalist ban on the hijab. So women can wear the hijab, the head cover, and still go to study. Because, you know, if you wear a hijab as a woman, you cannot study in any university in Turkey. Even if the university is private, it's illegal for you to study in that private university that does not receive government funds if you are covering your head. So the current government has removed that ban. But I think that the current government, it depends on all sorts of situations, a very complex situation, that if the current government were to push its own Islamic agenda on Turkish society, the army would interfere at any moment, because the army has the power to interfere. But of course, the other side of the matter is that the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the support of the Kurds of Iraq has been a blessing in disguise to the Islamists in Turkey. Yeah. Because now the army is very angry with the Americans. The army or certain elements within the army think and believe that the Americans are trying to encourage the Kurds of Iraq to establish their own pan-Kurdish state that would include most of Iraq, most of Turkey, half of Iran, and half of Syria. And that's a major fear. You know, there's no doubt that the generals in the Turkish army are scared of the Kurds. And that fear goes to the 19th century. It is not new. But now with the Kurds having their own independent zone in northern Iraq, an independent state, and constitution and flag, this has really scared off the Turkish army in a major way. And also the Kurds of Iraq are talking about this dream of a pan-Kurdish state. And if you read, you know, the man that they called the founder of the PKK, his name is Abdullah Öcalan, O-C-A-L-A-N, Öcalan, Öcalan in Turkish. He wrote his memoirs that came out a few months ago, that he published in London. And it's amazing what he has to say about pan-Kurdism. He was saying that we had a pan-Kurdish state 2,000 years before Christianity. Now it is the time for us because we are over 50 million people in Turkey, in Iran, in Iraq, in Syria, in Azerbaijan. So we have the right to reestablish our state. And if the Kurds were to succeed in doing that, it means that this would destroy Turkey as a state. Turkey would disintegrate as a state. But so far, I think, I mean, it's a very, very tough situation, a very sensitive situation. But I think that the Kurdish question has been a blessing in disguise for the Islamists. Because now the army is not pressuring the Islamists as much as it did before because of the Kurdish threat. And the seen American threat to the integrity of Turkey, that Turkey that was set up by Kemal Atatürk in the 1920s. Yes?
It seems when you look at the history of all countries, really, but in this particular region at the minute, nationalism seems to be a framework that's been established over the pressures that are there. In fact, there's another structure of differing visions of religion and its role.
Yeah.
And then beneath that is the ancient, almost tribal, ethnic loyalties.
Mm-hmm.
And and moving all of that today is, as this has always been the case. I mean, many religious wars were really powered by greed and power, you know, looking for more power and greed is the cause of religion for the purpose, doesn't matter who you're talking about. And you talked about how certain parts of the perhaps some countries, the Sunnis, are being influenced by other than religious political groups, if you will. My question is are there sort of almost geopolitical movements, like the massive movement from one place to another, Iranian people into, say, Istanbul as an example, changing the complexion and flavor of Istanbul and changing the needs of the people, the education level of the people, and expressing itself through religious frustration, political frustration, and really they are movements and change.
No, that's an important question. This happened in Iran under the Shah, because the Shah in 1962 embarked on what was termed at the time the White Revolution, the modernization of the countryside, the expropriation of land from the peasants, and that's why millions of peasants went to the cities, Tehran and other cities, and these farmers became like a fuel for the coming Shiite revolution. I mean, Khomeini understood that, that's to say the clergy understood that. And these people were religious by nature because they came from the countryside, and also they found they were alienated in the big cities, and the religion was a major security thing for them, and that's why they turned to Shiism. This is one major reason for the failure of the Shah's regime, is that that regime was not able to accommodate the peasants from the countryside. On the contrary, it had alienated them with its own white revolution and the giving of land to feudal landlords who were pro-Shah in orientation and westernized in orientation. So there was a major gulf in allegiance between the people on the streets who, you know, became very much committed to the Shiite clergy. Because during the Shah's time, there were 70,000 Shiite clergy who were in touch with the people. In a sense, they were the representatives. Most of them were anti-Shah and anti-state. And they represented Imam Khomeini in terms of his own access to the masses. In terms of Istanbul, it's very interesting. A friend of mine has written an article on that, about the center and periphery, but not in modern Turkey, but in the Ottoman states. Of course, the periphery, the Anatolia, the peasants, have always provided food for the center, for the cities. I mean, the bourgeoisie of the cities had been very, very talkative, very intelligent, but very lazy at the same time. It did not produce its own food. And there was an attempt, a massive attempt, by the Ottoman elites in the 19th century to modernize Turkey. And that's why there was more pressure put on the countryside in Ottoman Turkey, not only in Anatolia, but let's say in Palestine, in Egypt, in Iraq, to produce more food for the cities. And there was a form of economic renaissance in the countryside as well as in the cities. And that form paralleled another form of religious renaissance, especially Sufi renaissance amongst the peasants in Ottoman Anatolia or Ottoman Palestine or Ottoman Iraq or Ottoman Lebanon. Nowadays, you know, in the Arab and Muslim world, we see another form of resurgence of Sufism. But the major form of resurgence happened at the end of the 19th century because of this. But your first question about tribalism, it's very interesting to dwell a bit on the notion and phenomenon of tribalism, especially in the Gulf states. Because all of these tiny rich states in the Gulf states are controlled by tribes. So tribalism is not a matter of the past, it's a matter of the present. That the so-called nation-state of Saudi Arabia, or nation-state of Kuwait, or Yemen, or Bahrain, or whatever, all of these states are controlled and have been initiated by tribes. And what's more interesting is that the tribal system has been extremely powerful due to the international political system, especially the international political system of Europe and the states, and the fact that that system has supported tribalism at the expense of secular nationalism. And hence, let's say, you know, if you look at it from a philosophical perspective, the U.S. did not invade, after 9/11, did not invade Saudi Arabia, although most of, of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. They did not come from Iraq. And the U.S. wouldn't have even needed to invade Saudi Arabia, because it has enough power amongst the military hierarchy to start a coup against the Saudi family if it wanted to. But instead it invaded Iraq. It invaded a secular nation-state regime that allowed Christians, for example, to achieve higher political posts in the country, which is not the case in a country like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Bahrain. And that's very interesting for one major reason, that it is in the interest of the West, it seems to me, to preserve, if not to strengthen, tribalism in the contemporary Arab and Muslim worlds. And the Islamic movement is well aware of that. That's why somebody like bin Laden, if you read his own lectures and presentations, what he has to say about it, he's very angry with the Americans because they are propelling a backward tribal state at the expense of a modernized state. Because as an Islamist, he prefers a modernized state, a modernized Islamic state, to a backward tribal state. These debates are very interesting in the Arabic language, and a few people have written about them in English. Any last question? Mr. Abfadi is quiet today, Ali.
Well, I'm buying much more than selling, actually. Listening to you is a big gain.
That's
thank you.
Any other question from this side here?
I just wonder about these 70 professors that have no students.
Yes.
Would they at least use the time to do research on their field?
Yes, I mean, they do research, but, you know, most of them do not know any European language, because Turks are very nationalist. They know only Turkish and Arabic because of their own religious education. So they cannot become international researchers because of their lack of knowledge of European languages, which means that they don't have access to Western literature about Islam and Muslims. And Western literature is quite huge and diverse. And it is not new. It's at least 500 years old. So they have no access to that important literature on Islam and Muslim societies.
Maybe they have their resources from other...
They have their limited resources, but very often than not, they are not read by many people. And that's why there is an environment of desperation amongst the religious intelligentsia in Turkey. I mean, in Turkish standards, they are well paid. they make like $1,200 a month or whatever. That's a lot of money in the eastern part of Turkey. But in terms of their intellectual productivity, they are not that productive. And many of them are angry with the Kemalist system, but they have no power to change that system. Yes?
I would like to know how come that the army in Germany is the protector of the Kemalists? What kind of thoughts?
It's because of the nature of the state. You know, the Turkish army is the heir of the Ottoman army. It inherited the same structure and the same mentality. And we must not forget that the Ottoman army went through a major westernization process and modernization process in the 19th century. It had been highly westernized. And initially Germany, the German army, the Prussian army, was training the Ottoman army. And later on it was given to the French, and later after the occupation to the Americans, after the British, Russian, Greek occupation of Istanbul in 1919, it was given to the Americans. But also if you look at the nature of the Kemalist state, the state established by Kemal Atatürk, you know, as you well know, in World War I and before the war, Turkey lost over 400,000 men in the war. Most of them came from Anatolia, from the countryside. So there was a major depletion of human resources in Turkey. And Kemal Atatürk was very sensitive about that point. So when he established the state, his major mission had been to establish a welfare economy. And the economy had been welfare, so to speak, until the 1960s. Then the welfare mentality broke down. It became highly capitalistic and individualistic and all of that. And it led to so much corruption after, you know, we see corruption cases, major cases, happening in Turkey in the 1970s and 80s. But not in the 1950s and 40s because of the nature of the welfare state and the protection of the citizens of Turkey by the state. And in a sense, it was the government and the army that worked hand in hand to promote that welfare economy and welfare mentality that broke down in the 1970s. But the army stayed in power because of its own privileges. Yes?
Is there a red line between the government action and the army action if, in case one of the generals came and said, oh, you are exceeding the
limit,
you are...
There are many red lines, but these lines seem to shift. It depends on the political situation within Turkey and outside of Turkey. It's like reading a poem, like, you know, the current prime minister 10 years ago when he was the mayor of Istanbul, Tayyip Erdogan, he read a poem and he was jailed for like 8 months because of that poem. It was about Islam, Islamic regeneration. Lifting the ban on hijab is a red line, but it has been lifted and the army did not do much. And this is mainly because the government is a bunch of smart people who understand the domestic and international situation. In addition, of course, you know, the army is against any future integration of Turkey within the European Union. The army doesn't want that integration because it means that the whole model of Kemalism would disappear, that Turkey would be just another state within Europe. And the Europeans so far have rejected Turkey for their own reasons, for different reasons.
So it's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Atatürk period as a form of virulent modernization.
And westernization.
That's right. But now it risks the EU.
That's right.
Resists the EU.
And now the Islamists want to be part of the West.
Right.
Yeah, which is, it's very ironic.
If we could just maybe end on a slightly higher note, or more. Why is it that Turkey is still the most friendly country in the world? I mean, for all of this extraordinary movement back and forth, at least in my experience, Turkey is an unbelievably friendly place.
It's a beautiful country. You know, I'm not a Turk, but I was married to a Turkish woman for 7 years, and I had a chance to live in Turkey because it's a very beautiful country. Not only Istanbul, outside of Istanbul and all that. Yeah. And the economy is so vibrant and all of that. So if you come on our study tour, you'll have a chance to visit some Turkish people in their homes because we know lots of people. And I hope that some of you will join us. Well, thank you so much.
No place in the world. Thanks so much, Ibrahim.
Yes. Lovely.